Imagine a world where Santa Claus is a frightening bearded intruder, where va-va-va-boom translates to bombs exploding rather than romance, and where a Munty on your balcony becomes the highlight of your childhood. This is the vibrant, often hilarious world of Firuza Dumas, whose memoir Laughing Without an Accent has captivated readers worldwide with its warm humor and poignant observations about immigrant life. Since its publication, the book has become a staple in multicultural literature courses across American universities and has been translated into multiple languages. Celebrities like Mindy Kaling have cited Dumas as an influence, praising her ability to find universal humanity in specific cultural experiences. What makes this book particularly significant is how it arrived at a crucial moment in American-Iranian relations, offering a much-needed humanizing perspective that countered prevailing stereotypes with laughter and shared experiences. When my memoir was translated into Persian, I encountered a complex challenge that went beyond mere language conversion. Iran's position outside international copyright laws meant anyone could translate my work without permission or consultation. This situation created intense anxiety, not just about the quality of translation, but about potentially embarrassing my extended family in Iran, particularly since humor, with its subtle cultural nuances, is one of the most challenging elements to translate effectively. The cultural divide in comedy became evident in my own household long before the translation process. My family, though immersed in American culture, often found themselves puzzled by certain staples of American humor. Slapstick comedy, like pie-throwing scenes, left them confused, and Carol Burnett's famous Tarzan yell, which had American audiences in stitches, drew blank stares. However, they thoroughly enjoyed performers like Flip Wilson and Tim Conway, whose physical comedy and character work seemed to transcend cultural boundaries. These early experiences foreshadowed the complexities I would face in translation. After my initial translator became ill, I began working with Mohammed Soleimani Nia. Our collaboration became an intensive cultural exchange, examining each story line by line to preserve both meaning and humor. Common American phrases and cultural references required complete reimagining. Va-va-boom, a playful expression of romantic attraction in English, was initially translated literally as explosions, missing the flirtatious undertone entirely. References to Santa Claus, described as a bearded fellow coming down chimneys, needed careful handling in a culture where such an image might evoke fear rather than joy. Even seemingly universal concepts required cultural contextualization. Government censorship presented additional hurdles that demanded creative solutions. Three significant changes were mandated: removing a passage where a character blamed God for someone's nose shape, eliminating references to reincarnation, and excising an entire chapter about shared humanity across religious beliefs. Ironically, the very message at the heart of my book. Despite these required modifications, the translated work, titled Atre Sombol, Atre Koch, The Scent of Hyacinths, The Scent of Pine, resonated deeply with Iranian readers, achieving bestseller status with 30,000 copies sold in its first year alone. The book's success culminated in a Reader's Choice Award from an Iranian youth magazine, but the most meaningful feedback came from the magazine's editor. He emphasized how young Iranian readers particularly appreciated the book's balanced portrayal of different nationalities, avoiding the common trap of depicting one culture as superior to another. His poignant message, "We don't hate Americans," requested to be shared with my American audience, revealed how humor had achieved something remarkable. It had created a bridge of understanding between two nations often portrayed as adversaries. This experience demonstrated that while humor might not always translate directly, its ability to connect people on a human level transcends political and cultural boundaries. When I was 6, my father's job transfer forced us to leave our beloved home in Abadan for an apartment in Tehran. What I mourned wasn't the house itself, but our garden, where I'd spent countless mornings observing nature's small miracles. The determined ants carrying impossibly large crumbs, butterflies landing on my mother's prized roses, and the occasional brave sparrow drinking from puddles after rain. The bustling Tehran streets, with their constant noise and strangers, represented everything I disliked, a city without an off button. Car horns blared day and night, vendors shouted their wares, and the endless stream of people felt suffocating. My world shrank from wandering freely among flowering bushes and fruit trees to being confined to a tiny apartment on the third floor with just a small balcony overlooking the chaos below. With boredom as my constant companion, I discovered the dubious pleasure of eavesdropping on our shared phone line. I would sit for hours, receiver pressed against my ear, learning about Mrs. Amadi's wayward son, the baker's daughter's engagement drama, and countless domestic disputes. Despite neighbors' complaints and my mother's stern warnings, I continued listening to their conversations, becoming an expert on neighborhood gossip. Our evenings were spent watching the drama unfold at the police station across the street, a form of pre-television entertainment. We witnessed everything from minor traffic violations to dramatic family feuds playing out on the sidewalk, each incident providing material for dinner table discussions. Nothing compared, however, to the day a monkey from a local organ grinder appeared on our balcony. The creature, wearing a tiny red vest and golden cap, climbed up the drainpipe and landed gracefully on our railing. For 3 glorious hours, this unexpected visitor stayed with me, mimicking my movements, sharing my afternoon snack, and creating what felt like a perfect connection. His dark eyes seemed to hold wisdom beyond human understanding, and his gentle touch when accepting pieces of fruit made my heart soar. Despite my desperate pleas to keep him, my father gently showed me the desperate organ grinder searching in the street below, his livelihood dependent on his performing partner. The monkey was eventually lured down with dates and nuts, leaving me to wonder if he remembered our brief but magical friendship as vividly as I would for decades to come. These childhood memories reveal something profound about human nature. Even in confined spaces, children find wonder and magic in unexpected places. The balcony that initially represented my shrunken world became the stage for one of my most treasured childhood memories. Through my young eyes, that small concrete rectangle transformed into a theater box where city life unfolded below, a secret listening post for neighborhood stories, and ultimately the setting for an enchanted afternoon with an unlikely friend. Sometimes the smallest spaces can host our biggest adventures, and the briefest encounters can leave the most lasting impressions, shaping our understanding of joy and connection in ways that echo through our lives. My first American teacher, Mrs. Sandberg, completely bewildered me with her kindness. Her colorful classroom felt like a perpetual party, with children's artwork hanging everywhere, from finger paintings to science projects to creative writing displays. The walls seemed alive with learning. Unlike my stern Iranian teachers, she never yelled or hit students, yet maintained perfect control through gentle, logical conversations. When conflicts arose, she would gather students in a circle and guide them through problem-solving discussions, a revolutionary approach to my young mind. In Iran, we operated under a rigorous 20-point grading scale, where 19s and 20s were so rare that achieving them became legendary. A score of 17 was considered excellent, and anything below 12 meant failure. Teachers were stern authority figures who commanded absolute respect. The very thought of addressing them by their first names was unthinkable. We stood ramrod straight when teachers entered, responding in unison with, "Good morning, teacher." The slightest whisper during lessons could result in punishment. Our classrooms were austere spaces, with rows of wooden desks facing a blackboard, devoid of decorations or distractions. Iranian education prioritized core academic excellence through intensive daily instruction. Penmanship was considered a reflection of character. We spent hours perfecting our handwriting with special fountain pens. Mathematics wasn't just about solving problems, but understanding underlying principles. Science education was remarkably thorough. I recall spending weeks studying each part of a flower, drawing detailed diagrams, and learning Latin names. Our cultural education centered on Persian literary giants who shaped our national identity. Ferdowsi's Shahnameh, with its 50,000 couplets, wasn't just poetry, but a historical epic that preserved our language and culture. Hafez Ghazals were memorized and consulted like daily horoscopes, while Saadi's wisdom about human interconnectedness, human beings are members of a whole, became a universal message. The prestigious Al-Borj School exemplified Iranian educational excellence. Dr. Mojtahedi, its visionary principal, created a meritocratic institution where a poor but brilliant student could study alongside the wealthy. The school's alumni included numerous scientists, physicians, and leaders. While corporal punishment was a controversial aspect, the overall system produced remarkable results. Iranian immigrants consistently achieve high educational and professional success globally, from medicine to engineering to academia, testament to their rigorous early schooling. The cultural contrast in attitudes toward academic achievement remains striking. While American pop culture often portrays intellectually gifted students as social outcasts, Iranian society celebrated academic excellence as the highest achievement. Parents would proudly announce their children's test scores to neighbors, and top students were household names in their communities. Yet through these stark differences, Mrs. Sandberg's nurturing approach demonstrated that effective education could take different forms. Her lasting impact proves that while educational systems may vary, a teacher's genuine care and dedication can transcend cultural boundaries to shape lives permanently. My father's excitement over clearance sales led us to an engineering corporation's furniture liquidation. Armed with checkbooks, we drove separately, him in his two-toned Mulberry Buick LeSabre, which my brother called Dad's purple car, to my father's dismay, and me in our silver Chevette, a bare-bones car with terrible acceleration that had become the unofficial training vehicle for dozens of relatives. At the sale, we impulsively purchased two massive desks, chairs, and a file cabinet without considering transportation. When we attempted to load them into our cars, they protruded dangerously from all sides. Driving slowly home, we were stopped by an aggressive police officer who issued tickets for unsafe loads and prohibited us from continuing. I had to find a neighbor with a van to rescue us. Back home, we discovered the furniture was not only aesthetically challenged, but too large for our staircase. My father insisted on forcing the desk upstairs anyway, causing significant wall damage as it barely squeezed through my bedroom doorway. My room essentially became a desk with a bed attached. My mother nagged throughout the ordeal while my father stubbornly declared, "It looks great!" Years later, my parents couldn't give the furniture away. Even gardeners refused it for free. They eventually paid a handyman $100 to remove it, bringing the total cost of the bargain furniture, including tickets and repairs, far beyond its worth. My father now romanticizes the story as a father-daughter bonding moment, turning up the TV volume when I remind him of the actual expense. This episode perfectly captures the immigrant experience, the desire to seize opportunities, the determination to make things work against all odds, and the ability to transform mishaps into cherished family stories. My father's stubborn optimism in the face of obvious disaster represents the very resilience that allowed our family to build a new life in America, one oversized desk at a time. Most immigrants experience feeling like permanent foreigners, belonging neither here nor there. This liminal existence shaped me into the perfect party guest, adaptable and comfortable with strangers, as I'd learned to navigate social situations with heightened awareness. Like a chameleon, I could blend into any gathering, making small talk in multiple languages, yet never fully belonging. This sensation of perpetual outsiderhood, while sometimes painful, gave me unique social skills that would later prove invaluable. However, college social life deeply disappointed me. While most students embraced the typical undergraduate lifestyle of late nights, binge drinking, and casual socializing, I yearned for something different. I preferred early mornings with coffee and books, meaningful conversations about politics and philosophy, and genuine cultural exchange. I methodically tried joining various groups, attending church socials where I felt like an anthropologist observing rituals, volunteering at English practice sessions where I connected briefly with other immigrants, joining running clubs where conversation was limited to pace and distance, and even attempting to be a football spirit promoter despite knowing nothing about American football. Nothing clicked. Each group felt like another failed experiment in belonging. The turning point came at Berkeley's International House, where half the residents were foreign students from across the globe. With its striking 9-to-1 male-to-female ratio, my previously non-existent dating prospects suddenly improved dramatically. My roommate Debbie, whom I successfully convinced to adopt the more sophisticated Debra, and I found ourselves immersed in a vibrant community of global citizens. We met graduate students from Japan discussing economic theory over breakfast, Middle Eastern scholars debating politics in the common room, and European researchers sharing their cultural traditions during holiday celebrations. It was in this multicultural haven that I encountered Francois, a French doctoral student whom I initially dismissed after an awkward conversation about French literature where I pretended to know more about Proust than I actually did. After weeks of strategic avoidance in hallways and common areas, guilt finally prompted me to invite him for coffee. That conversation, which began awkwardly at 4 p.m., stretched until midnight as we discovered shared perspectives on everything from family expectations to the challenges of academic life in a foreign country. We continued meeting regularly, our conversations flowing between English and French, creating our own linguistic middle ground. Francois showed me his extensive book collection, carefully transported from Paris, and explained his initial awkwardness. He'd been living in a fraternity where meaningful conversations were rare and his attempts at intellectual discourse were met with blank stares. Just as I thought I'd found someone special, a linguistic misunderstanding nearly derailed everything. I thought he'd made an inappropriate comment about my chest when he had actually called me quite a jester. Our first kiss followed this clarification, and he hasn't used the word jester since, though it's become our private joke. This cross-cultural romance exemplifies how meaningful connections can form despite language barriers and cultural differences. The very displacement that made me feel like an outsider also equipped me with the ability to find common ground with someone equally out of place. Sometimes we find belonging not by sitting perfectly into one culture, but by creating our own shared space between worlds, a hybrid territory where differences become strengths and misunderstandings transform into intimate jokes. In this international microcosm, I discovered that true connection often happens in the spaces between cultures, where we're all equally foreign and equally at home. During my first pregnancy, I worked at a Fortune 500 corporation with generous benefits but a soulless culture. After witnessing a blind single father being laid off because he was the slowest, I questioned my workplace values. After my son's birth, I declined a promotion requiring international travel, realizing the women having it all philosophy was as unattainable as buns of steel. Motherhood brought sleep deprivation, isolation without a car, and complete life transformation. My mother visited for 2 weeks, obsessing over feeding me watermelon for breast milk production. She eventually convinced a stranger to carry an enormous watermelon up 2 flights of stairs to my apartment. Without extended family support, I struggled as a new mother, refusing parenting books after pregnancy books had only increased my anxiety. I watched my son constantly, discovering he rarely slept. My days became an endless cycle of feeding, cleaning, and desperate attempts at napping, punctuated by the monotonous ritual of laundry. Despite my attempts to find meaning in folding clothes, I only concluded, I hate laundry. When our children were 1 and 4, my husband and I bought a 2-bedroom fixer-upper. Unable to afford moving out during renovations, we built a room with bathroom behind our garage to live in temporarily. This coincided with my husband joining a Silicon Valley startup during the high-tech boom, working for a maniacal CEO obsessed with success who expected employees to work constantly. Living in one cramped room meant everyone woke when the earliest riser did. One particularly chaotic Sunday morning involved a bleeding child, stolen bagels, vomiting, and a diaper disaster on our new carpet, all within hours. I broke down crying when calling my husband, who came home immediately. Looking back at my son's first year photos, I see beyond my struggles to a baby who was loved, well cared for, and content with a mother whose buns were not made of steel. These challenging experiences taught me that motherhood isn't about perfection, but presence, showing up each day despite the chaos, exhaustion, and occasional despair. My father and his two brothers have developed a peculiar retirement ritual. Every weekday morning at 9:45, they gather at Uncle Nematola's house, because he owns a coffee maker, for their sacred viewing of The Price is Right. I discovered this secret accidentally when Uncle Nematola complained about my always arriving during their viewing time. When I finally joined them, I witnessed their passionate commentary on contestants, judging screams, outfits, and behavior as windows into character. They shout prices at the screen and become genuinely disappointed when contestants they dislike win. I don't know why any of you cares who wins, since it doesn't affect any of you anyway, I remarked, promptly getting banned from future viewings for talking too much. During the showcase showdown, all three brothers shouted prices at Bob Barker, genuinely upset when a contestant they disliked win using the $1 bidding tactic. No dignity, they muttered, looking truly disappointed. This scene perfectly captures how immigrants bridge cultures, adopting American entertainment while bringing their own cultural lens to it. My father and uncles transformed a game show into a moral commentary, finding community in shared judgment of contestants' behavior according to Iranian standards of dignity and propriety. When my uncle Abdullah passed away, his funeral reflected this cultural bridging. 600 people dressed in black gathered in a hotel conference room filled with enormous floral arrangements. My cousin Mahmoud recounted his father's journey from humble beginnings in southern Iran to life in California. Then, unexpectedly, he shared how his father had decided to learn flute at 70, practicing so badly the condominium association asked him to stop, prompting tentative laughter from the audience. My cousin Mehdi tried to speak but broke down crying, eventually sharing how his father had missed his son's birth because he got lost driving to the hospital despite practicing the route half a dozen times. The audience roared with laughter. In my eulogy, I noted that while Uncle Abdullah frequently got lost on freeways, his inner GPS worked perfectly in life. Like many emigrants, we found both what we sought in America and unexpected gifts. Girl Scouts, community colleges, public libraries. Though we swore never to change, America transformed us, and we changed America too, expanding palettes with Tadik and teaching that dancing isn't limited by age or ability. I'm profoundly grateful my 12-year-old daughter doesn't have to wear a hijab like women in present-day Iran. She's free to wear what she wants and pursue any career path. As she approaches her teenage years, I try staying connected while setting appropriate boundaries. Before entering a lingerie store targeting middle schoolers, I reminded her of our household rule: nothing written on the butt. Though she demonstrates good judgment, raising a daughter in contemporary American culture remains challenging. I'm stunned by music videos with cameras pointed up dancers' skirts and lyrics that make me nostalgic for when singers expressed love with innocent lines like, "Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely daughter." The media fixation on bad girls like Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton sends troubling messages about fame and success. Interestingly, my Iranian sister-in-law, who wore a hijab her entire life, is one of the most independent women I know, proving mandatory coverings don't necessarily make women submissive. Freedom is like a rope. Some make ladders to climb out of boxes, some make nooses, others make stripper poles. I hope my daughters use that rope to climb wherever they wish, then hold it for others, regardless of what they're wearing. Years ago, I was honored to deliver a college graduation speech, though most such invitations begin with, "Khaled Hosseini was not available." Despite speakers spending weeks crafting the perfect message, graduates generally want ceremonies to end quickly so they can celebrate. Realizing I couldn't remember my own graduation speakers was liberating. I was guaranteed to be forgotten. As graduates' names were called, many minorities, none wealthy, I felt hopeful seeing dreams fulfilled, especially watching a Vietnamese grandmother receiving her diploma. My father, watching proudly from the audience, likely thought of his sister Sadiga, who was denied education at 14. In that moment, I understood that education represents not just personal achievement, but intergenerational progress, each graduate carrying forward the unrealized dreams of those who came before. This is perhaps the most profound legacy of the immigrant experience, the freedom to choose one's path, to pursue education denied to previous generations, and to pass these values forward. Whether through humor, storytelling, or simply living authentically between cultures, we create bridges, not just for ourselves, but for all who follow.